You're listening to the Illustration Hour podcast, an interview podcast where I talk to illustrators, art directors, and agents about the craft and business of illustration. My name is Julia Dufossé, and I'm an editorial and commercial illustrator based in Chicago. And I'm chatting with creatives within the world of illustration to learn about their process, the challenges they faced along the way, and how to succeed as an illustrator today. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Illustration Hour. I'm your host, Julia Dufossé, and this week has been a dreary week in Chicago, where I'm based. We haven't had a summer yet, so that's been a bummer. But this week with me, I have Leon Edler. Leon is a conceptual illustrator and a cartoonist. He's known for his bright colors and his humorous concepts. He has this really amazing hand-drawn kind of style. I really encourage you to check it out. And he's worked with editorial clients such as The New Yorker and The New York Times, The Guardian, as well as many others. Leon's work has been recognized and he has been awarded several awards. Leon also co-founded the online marketplace Room 50, along with two art directors from The Guardian. Room 50 it's kind of an amazing concept, and I invite you to check it out at room50.com. It's a marketplace where Leon and his co-founders curate some of the best illustration work out there, and they allow you to purchase prints directly from them. They give 50% of the profit to the artist, and they also make a big effort to adequately represent women and people of color. And it's a great concept. It's a roster of about 50 artists, and it's just, there's some great work. So you should go check it out at room50.com. And you can find Leon on his website, which is Leilo, that's Leilo.com, or on Instagram at It's Leilo. And you'll be able to find the show notes for today's episode at illustrationhour.com/Edler. That's his last name, and that's E-D-L-E-R. So illustrationhour.com/Edler. Now, without further ado, let's get to my talk with Leon. Hello, Leon. Welcome to the show.
Hi there.
I'm really excited to talk to you about your work and what you've done with Room 50. So I want to get right into it and ask you, on your website, you describe yourself as a dirty commercial artist. And I was wondering why you describe yourself like that. I liked it, but I was wondering what it meant to you.
I suppose it was just like, for the avoidance of doubt, I'm not saying that I'm an artist. I'm just saying that I'm just a commercial artist. So I'm just being honest that that's dirty.
Yeah, why is it dirty?
I don't know. I suppose that was just, I don't know, I just kind of like the sound of it, of dirty mm-hmm. commercial artist. It's just making sure that this, I'm not being pretentious. I think one of my big fears.
Yeah. Do you sometimes feel like people judge you when you take commercial assignments? Is that part of?
No, I don't think so. I always think it's kind of like, I always feel like the illustration community is really like supportive. So no, I don't think so. It's maybe that I'm more judgmental. I guess there are people that I wouldn't work for, I haven't worked for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how do you usually describe yourself when you're talking to people in real life and people ask you, what do you do?
So I guess I'd just say an illustrator, but more specifically a conceptual illustrator. working mostly for like newspapers, magazines, so editorial stuff. I also do cartoons. That's how I started. I did more cartoons in the past.
Yeah. Are people ever surprised when you tell them that you make a living off of drawings, off of stuff that you make?
Yeah. And I don't at all take it for granted that I am able to do that now. It took a long time for me to get to a stage where I could live off it. And because of social media, you don't really know what people's situations are. And so I've realized more and more, especially since we started Room 50, which is an online shop I have that sells work by 50 other illustrators, that a lot of people whose work is fantastic and they've got huge online presence and lots of followers, they might actually still have two or three other jobs in the background. So I feel very lucky to be in a situation where I can live off my work, at least for now.
Yeah.
I always assume every job is the last.
Does most of your income come from commissions, from editorial commissions?
Yeah, by far. So I've got I've had a few regular jobs over time. I used to do something for the book review for the New York Times for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I used to do a comic strip for the Guardian, and then that became a weekly thing for quite a while. And at the moment, for the last 2 years, I've been doing the wine column for the Financial Times. So it's great having one or two regular things, and then everything else is just commissions as they come in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite rare for people to have actually like regular commissions like that. It's a really good situation.
Yeah, I mean, it took a long time, and it's really just constantly getting in touch with people. So when I like lost my regular job for the Guardian, I just contacted loads of people saying I'm looking for a regular job.
Yeah.
And it was just lucky timing.
Yeah, I do want to talk more about how you got started, but I read somewhere that you have a BA in linguistics from King's College in London.
Yeah.
What made you want to study linguistics? You were quite young because it was a BA, right? So
I went back actually. So started that when I was 25.
Oh, still young.
So, so I, because growing up, all I wanted to do was work in comedy, specifically TV comedy.
Mm.
I grew up loving like 1950s radio comedy, BBC radio comedy, and like from a young age, I was a real nerd. I'd go to sleep every night listening to comedy. And so that's what I wanted to do.
Did you aspire to be a comedian or a writer? Or?
No, not performance at all. So just writing it and producing mm-hmm. it was what I wanted to do. And so I used to do a lot of work experience, like hospital radios, radio stations around the country, BBC, just to try and get as much experience as I could. And then, so they told me to just do any degree. So I wanted to go and work for the BBC. So they just said, just go and do any degree. And when I was choosing my A-levels, which we have in the UK, which are the mm-hmm. exams that you do to get into university, I wanted to take art because I love drawing and doodling and doing cartoons and things. And they said, well, you're not good enough at drawing and you're not bad enough at science to do art. So I was kind of like, okay. They weren't necessarily wrong. I wasn't great at drawing, but it was a bit of like, oh, well, it kind of like prematurely closed down that avenue. And I just thought, well, I'll just do, you know, whatever they tell me, basically. So I did geography, geology, biology, and economics. And I mm-hmm. really loathed them. And I spent
all
most
of them.
I hated all of them, yeah. Well, biology was quite interesting, but the others I couldn't stand. And so I just spent most of the time playing snooker and darts. And I got really good at snooker and darts, but I didn't get very good at any of those other subjects.
Is snooker, that's billiard, right? Or a pool?
Yeah, it's like if you take a pool table and it's the table's like about 4 or 5 times bigger.
Oh, okay.
And it's like playing pool on a football pitch.
Okay.
It's really difficult.
Yeah.
So you can waste a lot of time doing it. And so that's what I did. And so I didn't do very well in my A-levels. And all my teachers said, oh, you could have done a lot better than that. You should retake these exams. So I thought, oh, well, I'll retake my geography exam. So I kind of wasted the year and then went back. And I got exactly the same grade again. So I've got two complete geography A-levels at the same grade. And then I just went to university and did geology. And then I got there and it was so boring. Mm-hmm. And I met all these people that were doing like drama and English and art. And I just thought, oh, what am I doing? So
And this was at King's College already?
No, this was at Birmingham. So this was when I was like 18, 19. So I dropped out of that, and then I went and did media at another university for like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But at that university, it was right next to a Greyhound racing track. And so I'd find that I was just going to go on, I was gambling on the Greyhounds rather than go to university. And so so then I just completely lost my way, like for a long time. And so the only thing that I kept doing was drawing and writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know what I was doing or where I was going. And I had a million different jobs working in offices. I was a debt collector. I was a bingo caller. I had a million different jobs.
I don't envy you, the debt collector.
Yeah, that was particularly grim. I didn't last too long doing that. And Then I wanted to travel. I wanted to learn another language. So I did a course that was teaching English as a foreign language. And I did that in London for quite a while. And I really enjoyed teaching. And then I went over to Chile. And I lived there for about 18 months. And I just so I learned Spanish and I became really interested in language. So I just wanted to study it, not with a view of doing anything with it afterwards, but just for the interest of linguistics. And I loved it. And it was the first thing that I'd done for a long time that was difficult, but I did well in it. And I think that gave me a lot of confidence to like go back and do the things that I really wanted to do without feeling scared, you know.
Yeah. So when did you finish the program at King's College?
So I finished that in when I was like 28, so 2009, 2010.
All right. Yeah. And so right after that, what were you doing after that?
So whilst I was doing that, I met my girlfriend, who's now my wife. And she saw the cartoons I was doing and she encouraged me to enter them into competitions.
What kind of competitions?
It was the British Young Cartoonist of the Year Award.
Oh, okay.
And so I won that twice in a row. And so that was obviously like a huge confidence boost.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, maybe I could do this. And I loved how immediate it was compared to writing a script or working in TV or anything like that. And I realized I also didn't like working in teams. So it was perfect. So then I started taking that really seriously. But I also fell in love with the drawing of it. And so after my degree, I went to work for a publisher, the Macmillan Publishers, and I was an editor there.
Mm.
And then whilst I was there, I just thought, oh, I can't take these office jobs anymore. I can't take working for somebody else. So I thought I'd do that for long enough until I could quit and become a freelance editor, and then slowly turn that into illustration work. So, you know, in all my free time, I would just be working on my style and doing cartoons and illustration and writing stories and, yeah, just working on that, really. And then started getting jobs and did less and less editing and more illustration.
And for people who are not familiar with your work, I think your illustrations they're funny and they have a very approachable kind of style. And there's something kind of good-hearted or about the way that you approach characters, and you kind of show the side of humans that is quite absurd and flawed. How did your style evolve? Was it really a struggle to find what you wanted to draw and how you wanted to say different things?
It was kind of funny. It's funny, like, the way you draw really affects the ideas you have. And so I love Gerard Hoffnung and, like, Jean-Jacques Sempé and people like that. And so I wanted to do this real kind of loose French European style. Mm-hmm.
It almost feels improvised, but
yeah, so
well
very,
improvised. Yeah.
But it just looked so shit when I was doing it. And at that stage, I had moved into a studio in Brighton. And so Nishant Choksi is in my studio. And he's been just an amazing mentor for me. And he would be completely, brutally honest.
And I'm not familiar with his work. What does he do?
He does, he used to do a lot of, it was all done on Illustrator. It's a real sort of 1950s style. And then he got really tired of that. And he does a lot of brushwork, and pen and ink. He does a lot of stuff for The New Yorker and stuff. You should check his stuff out.
I will, yeah.
He's really
amazing. I tried to check his website, but it's like, it seems to be offline or something.
Yeah, that's very possible. he would give me brutal feedback and just say, oh, this isn't good, that isn't. And I was trying to do all this loose stuff, and he was saying, well, if you can do cartoons, why aren't you doing conceptual illustration? And he really sort of taught me the importance of finding your niche, because there's a million different ways you can go with illustration. But if you're trying to do all of them, you're not really doing any of them. So you need to sort of focus on what you're good at and being really honest about what you're bad at.
What do you think you're bad at, for example?
I'm not great at drawing. I have.
You mean drawing in a realistic style?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah. So yeah. I try it all the time. I think, right, I'm going to sit there and I'm going to draw a still life. But everything just ends up with eyes on it or someone being snide in it. Or I just don't really get that much of a thrill out of doing representative drawing, and I've never really practiced it. And so,
well, a lot
really
of illustrators don't, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it was really, my style came from just simplifying it. And I realized, you know, it was Nish that was looking at my sketchbook and was saying, well, this is better than your final work. And, you know, it was probably about 3 years I was in the studio until I started doing the style that I work in now, and I really honestly felt like an actual click, like, oh, this is it, like, you know, I've been trying all these styles, but this is my style. And as soon as I found it, I just found that I could come up with so many more ideas.
Did you go through a lot, like a big range of different styles before you even stumbled upon that one?
Yeah, I used to use dip pens. I used to just like do characters just like with huge blobs of paint. All this different stuff. But you have to, I think you have to go through that. Until you find a way that works for you. And it's got to be, I mean, especially for editorial illustration, it's got to be something that you can do quickly, that you can do consistently, that doesn't look too much like anyone else's style and is unique and has its own voice and stuff. But I mean, I think that takes a long time.
Yeah, it does. Do you remember, you mentioned Sanpei, so you were looking at a lot of other works that you admired and trying to understand where your work fits. And that process can be difficult because there is just like a fine line between drawing inspiration and kind of copying somebody's style. Do you remember struggling with that?
I think you find people that you know, you do stuff and you think, oh, that looks too much like someone else. And then you sometimes see other people doing that to your work. But I think when you're just trying to find your style, there's nothing wrong at all with completely copying someone else's work as a private process.
Yeah, like an exercise for yourself. Yeah.
And I think 99% of styles are derivative. It's a progression, isn't it?
Yes, of course.
The stuff that's come before. I think like when you're just trying to find your style, it's fine to try copying other styles and see what feels good, what doesn't feel good, what you can do, what you can't do.
Yeah. And what I'm really hearing from you is that the most important thing for you was to kind of just draw and keep drawing until you found that style.
Yeah, but I think for me, the most important part of my work is the ideas. And it was finding a style that allowed me to come up with ideas and something that I could do that would quickly represent ideas. Because I think if the ideas aren't clear, then it doesn't work. And that's the bit I enjoy. I love editorial work because it's like problem solving.
Yeah.
Like, how can I take this complex group of ideas and distill it down into a, you know, 5 to 10 simple images? And then once one of them's chosen, then I think, right, this is the hardware now, the actual drawing.
Yeah. And I think all of your illustrations have an element of humor in them as well, which I think that's part of what you communicate with all of your illustrations. Not necessarily the case for all illustrators.
Yeah. I kind of feel, even when I was like teaching or with friends, or if I do a talk or something, I've always thought, like, unless it's funny, how do you know if it's working or not? I kind of feel like it's an easy measure, like if people like it. But also, especially with cartoons, you get away with bad drawing if it's funny. I don't know, I think maybe it's also a safety thing.
So in the beginning, when you were building your portfolio, I guess after you kind of discovered what your style was, were you self-publishing cartoons, or how are you putting projects in your portfolio?
It was really just starting just all self-initiated work, and it was a mixture of gag cartoons and like conceptual ideas and sort of things that you might see in the newspaper, and just building up a big body of consistent work. I think that's the best way to start. So it all looks consistent, like kind of consistent palette. So just so an art director can look at it and think that they'll come to you and you'll more or less know what you're doing as much as anyone does.
Yeah. And it's something that's very important in editorial work, especially because of the tight deadlines. Art directors like to know exactly what they're going to get from you, especially if they haven't worked with you before.
Yeah, because I think it's a big risk for art directors. You know, I've appreciated this more as I've done it more, and I've got friends now who are art directors. You know, they're really busy, and they're putting a lot of trust in you, because if you don't deliver to the deadline, there isn't always a plan B.
Yeah.
And so it's easy for them to just stick to the illustrators they know. But it's great that they don't. They do give people a chance. But I think that's why it's... I got my first few jobs when they'd been let down last second, or it was something that had to be done over the weekend or on holiday or overnight. And I think unless you really don't think you'd make it, you just have to say yes to those, because then you can get a reputation for being a safe pair of hands.
Yeah, thriving off of the failures of others.
That sounds kind of mercenary. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, I've been told that at the Guardian on the fast but decent list.
Yeah, so they have a backup list of people that they can rely on. Well,
yeah, so I was on that, but now often they'll
come to you first now, I'm sure, but
yeah, you never know.
Yeah. Well, I guess they don't tell you that you're like really their second choice.
No, sometimes you know if they haven't like if they show you a mock-up and it's completely someone else's work. Yeah. You know for sure your second choice.
Yeah.
But
and I mean part of starting out in editorial illustration, I'm sure you were familiar with this in the beginning, is having a really thick skin.
Yeah, but I haven't. I think I've got an incredibly thin skin that heals quickly. Mm. I feel wounded all the time.
Yeah. But you get over it really fast.
Well, I suppose you just think, well, yeah, then you just like lie in bed thinking, what else can I do?
Yeah.
And you just realize nothing. And so you're like, well, I suppose I better keep trying to do this then.
Yeah. What, for you, what's the most difficult part of this whole process? What are the things that really, I guess, what you were talking about being wounded?
What, like in terms of the rejection?
Yeah, is the rejection the hardest part for you, or the critiques?
No, I mean, I guess I'm kind of at a stage now where it's mostly positive. But yeah, at the start, like when I was sending out cartoons on spec, I sent a load to Private Eye. I don't know if you know Private Eye. It's a magazine in the UK that it's like the main place that prints cartoons in the UK.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know it, but yeah. So you sent them, a letter?
Yeah. I used to send them cartoons every week, like a bunch of cartoons.
And they didn't ask for them.
No, no. It's like the New Yorker. Like you just send them, and then they pick them or generally don't. And I just got them all back with a post-it note that said, hard to find a laugh here, all rather sad. And I just felt ill. But I think you just, everyone has that. And you just have to keep going. And I think it's also not having a plan B.
Yeah.
Because it's so hard. For most people, I know, I saw I think it was you just interviewed Seb Agresti, right?
Yeah.
And I saw him answering questions on Instagram, and someone said, oh, how did you get your first jobs? And I think he said, oh, I just quit my job, and then It's Nice That did a feature on me, and I've never contacted an art director.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought I was going to be sick on the floor. I was just like, my God, that is like, I'm sure that, I mean, I hope that's not the experience of most illustrators. It definitely wasn't my experience.
I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, a lot of them do have to really ask for it.
Yeah. Because, but, I mean, Seb Agresti's work is so great, like so beautiful. He's such...
it is, but it also, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people who have beautiful work who weren't discovered so fast.
Yeah. I think it's also... you know, your work is only an aspect of it. I think there's probably amazing musicians, artists, writers and stuff that they just can't keep putting up with the bullshit and the rejection. And so they just think, oh, I'll just do something else. I don't need this.
Well, for you, you had so many jobs in the past that I assume you didn't think, oh, there's something else for me.
No, I tried everything. And, yeah, knew that there really wasn't anything else I could do or would want to do. But I was really lucky as well with my wife. You know, when I'd say to her, I don't know if this is going to happen, I should probably get a proper job. And she would say, well, I'd rather be with someone who's trying to do something they really want to do than someone who's miserable doing something they don't want to do.
Yeah. I was going to say, yes, the support that you get from your loved ones and is really important. And you have kids now. So, and I assume that the anxiety and the stress of providing for kids is something that is incredibly hard to deal with when it comes to having freelance work. And
yeah, we've got two 4-year-old twins.
Wow. Yeah, twins.
So, yeah, there have been long periods of just insanity. But my wife worked as well.
Yeah. And that helps, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It is really stressful at times. But yeah, you know, if big picture, we're really lucky. So I can't really complain about
it. I think what can be hard also is talking to other people, especially older generations and people who, I don't know, it's not that they judge you, but they don't really believe that you can really do this.
that you can do this for a living.
Yeah. Or also that you can. And not go into an office every day and still make a living.
Oh, yeah.
There's a real stigma there. I mean, I don't know, even my parents who aren't old, not my dad, but my mother, I don't think she believes in it.
Really?
Well, I mean, I think she wants to, but she partly is very pessimistic. I can feel it.
I mean, I've felt that totally from friends that I went to school with.
Yeah. It's sort of like thing where they say, the school, oh, that's great, but like you can tell they think, ooh, like.
Yeah, I think they understood it better when I wasn't able to live off it. They're like, well, yeah, of course. You can't just do that.
Yeah.
And now that it's going okay, that's, I feel like there's more judgment there actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I would feel vindicated and I've got this urge to prove people wrong in any way that I can. So I would feel like I can shove it in their face afterwards.
Yeah.
But I guess, oh, do you feel like now people think, oh, that's not going to last?
No, I don't think so. I mean, like it'll always be at a wedding when I'll meet, because for the most part, you know, where I live in Brighton as well is like everyone's an illustrator or a designer. So they kind of get it. And my, you know, close friends know what I do.
Yeah. But I'm not counting those people because those wouldn't be the people who wouldn't understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if I go to a wedding and people ask you what you do, you realize people don't know what an illustrator is. So it's always the same conversation. You say, they say, what do you do for a living? I say, I'm an illustrator. And they always say, so what's that like, political cartoons? You say, no. And you have to explain to everything you see that's drawn that's an illustrator. Yeah, and then they do say, so can you live off that? So yeah, you're right, like people, there is surprise about it.
Do you feel like people don't take you seriously as an adult sometimes?
I suppose I don't care enough to even wonder.
Mm.
You know, I suppose because I've had such a convoluted route to doing it, having done so many jobs and being in, like, so depressed at times.
Yeah.
That I kind of just feel, like, so grateful that I don't really care. Like, I mean, what anyone else thinks.
Yeah. And there is something horribly depressing being stuck in a, like, a 9-to-5 or like a job that you really don't care about. And having to do things for people and just, I mean, that's just a horribly depressing situation usually.
Yeah, I think offices are, I think the whole environment is so overwhelming that the work you're actually doing in there is irrelevant.
And being disconnected from reality too, because they are disconnected to reality from reality sometimes.
It's such an artificial environment.
Yeah. I used to work in a library and I thought that was incredibly like alienating because
oh really?
I liked books, but the work that we did was like barcoding and and putting books into categories, and it felt really, really artificial. And
does time move really slowly in the library?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
And also
shops when you work in a shop.
Well, I didn't interact with people. I wasn't on the people facing side even, so it was just like piles of books that you had to categorize and put into the system, so it wasn't fascinating.
Oh, yeah,
the only fun part was opening packages of new books, and sometimes they were art books or cool books,
so you get to flick through them.
Yeah, but not even really.
Yeah, that's slim pickings though, isn't it?
yeah. But I think even there are some better jobs, but jobs that you just don't see yourself doing. Jobs that pay relatively well, and people want to have those jobs. But if that's not really your thing, it can be incredibly painful still.
Yeah.
What was your least favorite job that you had?
There's so many. Debt collector was pretty bad.
Yeah.
Because you're just... It wasn't like door to door. It was over the phone. So people would buy TV or a jacuzzi. And then you would have to call them up and ruin their day. And you're allowed to call them 5 times before it's legally harassment. So I'd call the same people over and over again. Yeah. And you're just ruining people's day.
Yeah. I pictured the guy who goes to the house and reclaims the house or whatever, which is even worse.
I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that. I kind of did that, but over the phone.
Horrible job. Yeah.
Yeah.
Horribly depressing.
Yeah. But other people I worked with used to get offended by the abuse. And it just didn't bother me at all.
Oh, you mean people getting irate about you trying to collect debt?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like people would tell me if I called them again, they're going to come down to the office and shove the jacuzzi in me and stuff. I'd say, okay, great. All right, I'll speak to you tomorrow. Bye.
Yeah.
And I sort of found that entertaining, if anything.
Yeah.
It's when you're calling people and they're like at the end of their rope. That's when it's depressing.
Mm-hmm.
If they're just angry and abusing you, I thought, oh, this is sort of interesting.
Yeah. I guess the least you could do is take it, let them take it out on you, I guess, when you're doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was bad. I used to work for a flooring company paying their bills. And this was on a trading estate in Mitcham, which is like a grim little place just outside London. That was bad. I liked working in a pub.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, that would be more interesting.
Yeah, that's good. Shops are really boring. Time moves really slowly in shops.
Yeah, but it's in a way better than an office, at least for me, I would think.
Yeah, offices were the worst for me.
Yeah. How did you approach self-promotion in the beginning? Did you have a plan or did you just kind of play by ear?
Well, I mean, because I didn't study art or illustration or anything like that. I mean, I've been told actually that you don't really learn too much of this stuff anyway. But I joined the studio in Brighton. I don't think I'd be, I know for sure I wouldn't be doing this now if I hadn't, because I got so much advice from the people there.
So it was just like a shared workplace?
Yeah, so it's just a shared workspace. So in there, there's just lots of illustrators, designers, a couple of writers. And they were all just so generous with their advice and their time. And their criticism and being honest and really just genuinely trying to help you out rather than saying, yeah, that's great. And so...
Did you have to really seek out their critiques and their help, or did they sort of offer it to you?
I guess it was kind of a mixture, but I was talking to Nish about this the other day because I was telling him again, like, you know, how great he's been and how much I appreciate his help and advice over the years. And he was saying, well, it was easy because I took it. I wasn't sensitive about it. I mean, actually, like I was saying, I think I've got a thin skin, so it was kind of like devastating inside. But I really trusted him.
Yeah.
And I knew it was completely beneficial. So yeah, it might not be what you want to hear, but it makes you better.
Yeah.
And it also means that when you get good feedback, it feels great.
Yeah.
So
working in a studio really helped you, at least in the beginning.
Oh yeah, big time. And so because also when you don't have work,
yeah,
you're still going into a workplace. And so it gives you the incentive to produce work.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important thing, that when you don't have work, make the work that you want to be doing.
Yeah.
So, like, I had my first agent was always saying, oh, you need to do more maps. And I thought, I don't want to draw maps. So what's the point in drawing maps? Because then if people come to you and say, can you draw a map? And you just think, well, I don't want to draw maps. I'm not good at maps. That's not what I'm good at.
Mm-hmm.
So you're asking me about, you know, promotion and stuff. I was pretty organized about that. I'm not generally very organized, but I was really organized about that. So I would try and find email addresses of everybody, particularly people I wanted to work with. So I would guess email addresses. I'd work out the way the emails worked at the New York Times or something. And so I would guess everyone's email addresses,
mm-hmm.
And make a big long spreadsheet. And I would make sure I'd contacting everybody every 2 to 3 months. So I sent
them. What sort of thing would you say?
So I'd just send a really short, polite email, maybe, mm-hmm. with a link to my website. Not trying to be funny. Just polite and quick.
No questions, just kind of a statement.
Just a statement. This is what I'm good at. This is what my work's like. This is a link. Literally two sentences.
Yeah.
Always being polite.
Yeah.
And
if you got no responses, you still sent out another email two months later.
Yeah, because at the start, you don't get any responses. I think the best way to view is every 2 to 3 months, you just send out the emails and the mailers.
You remind them, yeah.
And then just forget about it. Like, that's just part of your routine. Just send it. But if you're expecting to hear back from everybody, you're just going to be really disappointed. So what's the point?
It's yeah.
just part of the process.
I think probably less than 10% of people really... will respond. I mean, depending.
Most of them won't even, like, if you get 50% of them even opening the email, that's good.
Yeah, and there's ways to track that.
Yeah.
And I think art directors, they even put it in a folder of emails that just are like the same emails from illustrators that are sending their portfolio, and they just kind of save it in case they need anyone.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But I think also you can send stuff that shows an interest in the art director's work, because the art directors are artists as well. You know, they're designers, and they've got an interest in their own work. And if you show that you follow their work and you're particularly interested in it.
How did you demonstrate that in the beginning? Because one of the ways that you can do that is to give them a compliment. And of course, the compliment can feel more sincere if it's backed up by actually explaining what you like about their work. And I know some people sometimes will send specific artwork that's directed at a particular art director. But how did you do it?
Well, I'd always wanted to work for The Guardian. And so Chris Clark, who is the deputy design director there, and he's an incredible designer, and I always wanted to, and he's really generous as well. Like he will take the time to try out new artists, and he's really interested in people's work and stuff. I used to send stuff direct to him. Like, he was doing a big he was renovating this house and stuff, and was putting stuff about that on Instagram. And I sent him a card that just said, "I think I preferred the old house." and so, like, that's not specifically related to his work, but I know that he would specifically engage with that.
Okay. So, did you hear back from him?
So yeah. So he's like a good example. So I was contacting him for a few months. And didn't hear back.
Yeah.
And then eventually did, and he was quite an early supporter of my work, and was really encouraging, and spent a lot of time, and that's the same with some other art directors, and so those 6 months didn't mean that he didn't like the work. It's just, you know, he's incredibly busy. He's got a million people contacting him all the time.
Yeah.
And it just takes a long time before you get on the radar.
Yeah. And this is something I've heard from a lot of people. I mean, not only you. And yet it's advice that's hard to take for me, even. I think when I email someone and I don't hear back, I don't email them again. And that's...
Oh, yeah, that's a big mistake.
Yeah, yeah, but it... Part of me sort of feels like, I mean, I'm not going to spam their inbox with emails.
But it's not it's kind of like the, there's some statistic about advertising, isn't it? People need to see something six times or something.
Yeah.
Before they register it.
And I know
it's exactly that. It's exactly that.
But it's again, the thing about taking things that you don't need to take personally, but you take them personally anyway.
But I suppose, imagine it. Like, this is exactly what I thought, was that I thought, I've you know, gone to all this effort to make these postcards and to send it to this person. I even drew on the envelope.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine they're just sitting there with their feet up on the desk and this comes in and they can't even be bothered to reply to me.
Yeah.
But it'd be like, imagine you were running for a flight and someone hands you something.
Yeah.
It's probably more like that.
Yeah. Well, even when I look at my my texting, I just see that I don't respond to close friends for a week sometimes.
Exactly.
And I'm like, wow.
I'm the same.
That's horrible. and like, yeah, I mean, those are my close friends. So I can only assume that somebody you don't know, you wouldn't respond immediately.
Mm. Yeah. So, I think it is just, you should just see it as it's not like you're personally contacting someone. It's just promotion.
But I dread the email part. I dread it so much. It's, you know, I try to make myself do it every day, or like every week I have to do a certain amount, and I just hate it.
Oh, well, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't. I used to take like 2 to 3 days where I would just zone out. Like, I'd listen to a podcast or something.
And send emails?
Just send emails.
Oh, so you take like 2 or 3 days off of all other work and just do it?
Yeah.
And how often would you do that?
Like every 3 months. Or send out letters. And I actually got to, like, because I used to dread it. And then I thought, this is just like a nice admin break where you can switch your brain off.
Yeah, maybe I should start doing it like that. I just feel like doing it every week is, it takes too much out of your daily kind of
exactly,
work.
Exactly, yeah. Just take, and then because you're sending a few emails, you emotionally engage in them too much. Whereas if you're just sending like 200 emails.
Yeah, but see, I didn't do it like that. For me, I was like researching someone very deeply, kind of trying to find something unique to say about their work or something. And so it took me a long time.
I would just do that with the people like you're desperate to work for.
Yeah.
You can't do that for everyone.
It's not sustainable. Yeah.
No. You'd have a mental breakdown.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something I have to get back into. And I have a database, which is just like a spreadsheet. I mean, but.
Yeah.
God, yeah.
It's also, if you're doing it in a way that makes you not want to do it, then it's counterproductive anyway.
Yeah, it is. But
you have to do it.
It can really feel pointless because you don't hear back. You kind of, I don't know. It, to me, sometimes it just feels very pointless, but.
Oh, yeah.
I know it's not. It's just, yeah.
I wish I could go back and say, this is actually going to work out. I know this feels like 100% this isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
But I honestly think it's more of a process than people realize.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that if I give it all I've got and it doesn't happen, then it's really because of the talent.
It will, so, but it'll...
So you then you're to... just like, if I try a little bit, it's like I can still fool myself that the talent isn't part of it.
Yeah, but that's trying a little bit at a diet, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's exactly like that.
Yeah, like, it's a mind trick. It's just like, yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because also then if you don't really try, then you haven't failed.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, like, I think, you just have to say to yourself, do I want to do this or not?
Yeah.
And I think if you do, then you just have to really go for it. But for a long time, that's what's hard. It's just that feeling of like you're farting in a hurricane.
Yeah.
Like, because I used to think, fuck, is anyone even seeing these emails? Because at least in the old days, you'd go around with your book and someone would say, yeah, these are awful.
Yeah.
Or these are great. We'll think about it. But if you're just sending emails and you're not getting replies.
You don't even know if it's reaching people.
You don't know. You're not getting any feedback.
Yeah.
So it's hard. It's really hard.
Do you remember how long it took for you to get your first kind of answer?
Oh, I don't know about my first answer. I know that there was a big difference when I changed this style.
Oh. So you started emailing before you had your style that you have now?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then my first job in this style was for the New York Times.
That's amazing, yeah.
And it went so badly.
Really?
Yeah, it went really badly. So yeah. So I had to do it all in a day, which is okay. So I sent off the sketches and they were like, yeah, this one's kind of working. Can you just play around with it some more? So I tried all these different things and they're like, yeah, you're nearly there. Can you try something else? And then it wasn't working. And then this sort of went on for hours, like all day. So I started at like 8 in the morning. This was up to about midnight. And then they just said, oh, actually, let's just go for one of the other sketches.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And so then I thought, okay, well, I'm going to really work that up. And then they said, actually, we just preferred the sketch. And so I just came away thinking that was a complete car crash.
And this was with Matt Dorfman, right?
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you know that?
Because I read it in an interview, I think.
Oh, really?
And Matt is, I mean, he's a huge art director at the New York Times. He works with a lot of super
talented. That's what made it feel particularly bad.
Yeah.
It's just like, wow, I've really fucked up with the wrong person.
Yeah. Have you found that to be true? Because I know you've worked with him since.
Yeah, I kind of contacted him a few times that year, basically saying, I'll be better next time and stuff like that. But trying to sound way more confident than that.
Yeah.
And then I worked for him. Then he asked me to do the author's note for the book review quite a lot. And then it was great working.
It went
with
better.
Him. Yeah, then it went better. Yeah.
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 I'm sure they experience this sometimes working with someone who hasn't worked with a lot of art directors, and like,
yeah,
it doesn't go smoothly the first time.
But I think I don't know. That's the only time I've really had that.
Really?
Like, normally it goes well, yeah. And there's a big difference working with a good art director and a bad art director.
What makes an art director good for you? Like, what helps you do your job?
So they know exactly what they want in terms of what you can do, what you can't do, the angle that they want, but then leaving you a lot of freedom. Like, them having the confidence in you for you to do your job.
Mm-hmm.
The worst is when someone tries to micromanage you and is trying to get you to include every single element of an article into an illustration.
Yeah.
Which just kills it, because then it's so messy and unclear. Or you're trying to, rather than letting you come up with ideas, they're trying to
give
you're
you
trying,
ideas.
You're trying to draw what's in their head. And
yeah.
I personally can never get that right.
Yeah.
So I much prefer, you know, when you're given clear guidance and then a lot of freedom. And then also, because you're so like appreciative of that, that you do your best work as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a mixture of direction and freedom and trust, really.
Yeah. And if you trust them, then if they're suggesting different colors or changes,
yeah,
it really just improves your work.
Yeah. But it sort of has to feel, I imagine, like they have a reason, like a legitimate reason for changing your work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you actually find that the sort of thing that you were just describing with art directors kind of either not really knowing what they want, or trying to shove everything about the article into your illustration, or making you draw what they're imagining, do you feel like that happens a lot?
No, not really. I think I generally find most art directors are good.
Yeah.
And that they know that that's what gets the best work. And I think also that comes as well with time, like trust. So when you're starting out, maybe they think that they need to give you more guidance and stuff.
But yeah, yeah.
I often find that people come to me because they like my ideas. So they're coming to me for an idea as well as an image.
What about commercial clients? I know you've worked with Warby Parker and a couple of other clients that are like companies.
Recently.
Do you enjoy that type of work? Or?
Yeah, I'd love to do more of that.
And of course, it pays better.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a big part of it.
Yeah. But,
I mean, working with Matt at Warby Parker was like a dream come true.
Yeah. And you designed a mural for...
Yeah, so it's five murals, actually. So So I did one for inside the shop, or the store, as you'd say. Behind
in
the
New
counter.
York or...
No, it's in Wisconsin.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then three like long, thin ones. So I was sent all the sizes. And then one that I haven't shown yet is like this 64-foot long external mural, but it has to be signed off by the city. So we're just waiting for that.
So that was a pretty big project.
Yeah. So it was really big. And yeah, again, he just gave really clear guidance and then completely left it to me to come up with loads of different ideas.
Yeah, because they've worked with quite a few artists that I admire, but they seem to let the artists really decide what they want with the story they want to tell in the mural. And
they've put a lot of trust in you.
Yeah.
But what I really loved about it compared to editorial was the sort of luxury of time.
Mm. And so, what was the time for that particular commission?
I guess it was kind of tight for that, but it was like a couple of weeks, huh. 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, shorter than what I would imagine.
Yeah. But, you know, for editorial, it's often a few days, like, or a day or hours. So, yeah. Like, it was really nice, like, if something wasn't working, thinking, right, well, I'll just look at this again tomorrow. You know, it's really fantastic when you see your work on a wall or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really exciting. And so I'd really like to do, yeah, more stuff like that, just like on a project.
Yeah. How did they find you? Do you know? Or?
Well, yeah, because I just joined this agency.
Mm. Okay.
Called How Do You Do?
Yeah.
And Anna there said to me, what kind of work would you like to do? And I said, well, a dream job would be working for Warby Parker. And she said, oh, well, I actually know Matt there. She contacted him on the Wednesday that I joined. He said, I've seen his work, I think just on Instagram. I like him. Actually, he'd be perfect for something. And so I started doing it like on the Friday.
Wow.
So it was, yeah, I mean, that's happened once along with, you know, about 20, 30 things that have fallen through. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So that never really happens, but it was great.
So, yeah, like a lot of illustrators now talk about, you know, that you don't really need an agency in the time that we live in, that, you know, with Instagram and all these things, people have access to your work and you have access to people that you never had access to before.
Mm.
But I guess I'd like to hear from you, like, what you think about that, seeing as you do have, you have two agents, right? You have an agent in France,
No, I was with Tiffane for a while.
Oh, okay, so you're no longer with them.
No, I got a really French email from her saying, it seems your work isn't popular in France. Do you mind if we drop you? And I said, well, no, I suppose not. I mean, what can I say?
I'll apologize on behalf of my French.
No, I love it.
Yeah.
I love that French, yeah, directness. Yeah. Obviously, yeah. It came with the, I felt deeply wounded as well. But,
And How Do You Do is based in the US or?
No, so Anna's just, it's like a one-woman show. She's in Cambridge.
Okay, I didn't know.
In the UK, and she just started recently. Yeah, so she's really going out there and meeting lots of people, and she seems to have a lot of energy. And
yeah, I mean, it sounds like kind of the ideal agent, where you told her what you really aspire to do, and she kind of went out and made that connection for you.
Yeah, it was great. But I found more and more that my work is popular in America.
Mm.
I think in terms of having an agent, if you don't need an agent for editorial work.
Yeah.
That's all just emails and Instagram and things like that. But I think probably for commercial work, a big brand probably feels confident with an agency.
Yeah. It's also about the way that they'll be able to negotiate with your agent.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people, I don't actually really mind negotiating or asking for more money or.
Yeah.
Anything like that. The only frustrating thing about that with branding and commercial work is when they just ghost you, which seems to be a really like common thing. So
what do you mean, like when they commission you and then you don't hear them?
No, they'll ask you for a quote.
Yeah.
And then so you can suggest an amount, thinking, well, if that's too high,
they'll get back to me.
They'll get back to me, but they just don't.
Yeah, that's happened to me before. And
it's
was
really frustrating.
It was really weird. I even tried to call and then I never heard back from them.
Yeah. Yeah. They just, it's just like,
I was like,
it never existed.
Yeah.
It's so rude.
And it was like, they never, ever contacted me.
Yeah. I know. Really, it's strange. So annoying. But,
yeah.
So now if I try and be quite firm saying, you suggest a price or what's your budget or something like that.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, I could see how that would help, but also sometimes I guess it does help to quote them something. If I mean, it really depends.
I was thinking of starting to send like a PDF quote and saying on it, please don't ghost me.
Yeah, I mean, I assume they do that because they found somebody that they want to work with, or and they just figure...
Or cheaper.
Yeah, and they figure, like, I don't need to answer this. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be nice to let people know, I think, but...
Well, yeah.
Strange.
It's just
yeah.
Common decency, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I want to talk about Room 50, of course, and I saved that for last because I think it's really interesting what you're doing with Room 50.
Yeah.
And I think you launched it with Chris Clark from The Guardian, right? Who's the art director or...
Yeah, Chris Clark and
creative
Ben
director.
Longdon.
Yeah.
Yeah, creative director, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. And with another art director from The Guardian?
Yeah, and Ben Longdon.
Yeah.
I think he's technically like the digital version of Chris.
Okay.
Chris is all print and Ben's all digital.
How did that happen? How did you guys decide to, I mean, where'd the idea come from and how did, yeah.
Well, I've been talking to someone at a party who isn't involved in illustration or design or anything. And she was saying she'd love to get some prints for her house, like good quality, interesting illustration stuff, but she couldn't find anywhere to get them. And she was particularly interested in female artists.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, I could write down a list of 50 amazing female illustrators who would probably sell their work. And then I was thinking, well, and so I was looking online and there just didn't really seem to be any one place that other than print on demand sites that sell a huge amount of work and it's not curated.
Yeah.
So, you know, there might be some great work on there, but there's so much stuff on there and a lot of it's crap.
Yeah.
You're
talking about places
great.
Like Society6 and Redbubble and those really
yeah.
huge marketplaces.
Yeah. Which I think are off-putting. And they don't give much to the artists either.
No. And I think also that there's a lot of popular art on there that's just like, it feels farmed out and not
yeah,
exactly like somebody put any thought into it.
Yeah, there's not much heart or soul in it.
Yeah.
So then the next stage is kind of like high-end galleries that are selling G-Clay prints for a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
But there are people that, you know, want to buy nice prints for their home. They don't want to spend a fortune on it. And there are a lot of illustrators who might have just a big cartel shop or something like that, and they're not going to get the traffic. And so I just thought, why don't we just, you know, we've worked with a lot of illustrators, or they're our friends, or there's some amazing people out there. Why don't just combine forces as a big group of 50 people and sell the work that way and give a fair amount of the profit to the artists? And
I think you give 50% of profits to.
Yeah. So 50% of the profit goes to the artists.
It's huge.
Yeah. So, our aim is to make sure that there's a lot of women and people of color on the roster.
But also that it's mostly a curation and you don't have an unlimited amount of artists on there. You have very select.
It's always
kind of
50
list.
And we do it in seasons, but then we want it to be really accessible. So, we sell in the 4 different sizes
yeah.
to suit you. So you just find a piece of work that you like. And then depending on the size or the amount you want to spend, you can choose based on that. So we just wanted it to be exclusive, but to take all the elitism and cliqueiness out of it, which I think puts a lot of people off buying art.
Yeah.
You know, there's no reason that art should feel like that.
Are they usually signed your
No.
No. Okay.
No. So because the artists are all over the world.
Yeah.
It would just, and because we give so much profit to the artists, it just wouldn't be workable to.
And they're not limited editions usually.
No. So when we started, they were limited editions.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we were just going to have to close. So we, because none of us had run a business before, we've made mistakes and we've learned a lot as we've mm-hmm. gone along. And so we've changed things, but yeah, it's always, most important thing has always been that we're fair to the customers, the artists, and that the quality is good.
Yeah.
And that we're really transparent. So we've seen a lot of other people pop up with similar stuff since we started.
Yeah.
But they still just say we give a fair amount of money to the artists or
yeah,
and this and that. But, you know, if it was really fair, they would say how much it was.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I appreciate how your website, it's extremely clear about what you guys do, what makes you different, and what makes you ethical in terms of paying the artist.
Yeah.
But I wonder, like, how you're able to keep prices so low with, like, because, I mean...
Well, we just don't make a huge amount of profit. So the idea is yeah, really that the profit will eventually come when more people hear about us, because we've only had like really good feedback. People really like the concept and they like prices.
But to keep it up and running, you have to make a certain amount.
Yeah. And also we've got a manager, Ellie, who runs it. And we used to, like last year we had our assistant, Hannah. She's recently had to leave and she was fantastic and does all the day-to-day running. And now Ellie does it and she's really great. And so we couldn't do it without that support because, you know, we've all got our full-time jobs.
Yeah. And what is your role in the whole, like, what do you typically do?
Well, I mean, it's got less since we've been able to get Ellie involved and Hannah. But yeah, to start with, it was bonkers. So to start with, we just used like a local printer and I bought frames in bulk. So they were all like delivered to my studio.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the packaging. And so...
Oh, so you were shipping everything yourself?
No, so the printer would do it.
Okay.
But every week I would have to drive around there with frames and packaging.
Ah, okay.
And constantly contacting suppliers and I was answering all the emails from customers and...
Yeah.
And it was, yeah.
It's a full-time job, yeah.
Yeah, it was a full-time job. And then I found that I was just squeezing my illustration work into like pockets of time, which I really resented. So then, yeah, it's just finding a way of making sure we can run it whilst we also have these other, you know, our own work as well.
Yeah.
But it's really important to three of us. And we've also become, you know, really good friends as it's gone on.
Yeah.
So that's been really great. It's been really nice. I think because I've always thought I don't really work well in the team. And being an illustrator is...
it's sort of lonely, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a lonely job. It's been really nice working on those guys on a project and on something we all really believe in and we think could be really big.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we hope it could be.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of imagine it's hard to compete with places like Etsy and...
Yeah.
I mean, they don't exactly have the same model, but not at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, people are into getting something really cheap sometimes. I mean, that's probably not your customers particularly, but...
No. I mean, yeah, we've kind of reached a point where we're maybe looking for investments or something like that, just because, you know, a lot of people on Instagram that work in design or illustration know about us.
Yeah.
And, but their aim from the beginning was so that like our mums would know about us. So anyone that just wants a nice print for their house.
Yeah.
Whether they're just like a design guru or just someone who's buying their first house or renting a house, just that everyone thinks, oh, we want a nice piece of art, let's go to room 50. And we need to work out how we're going to reach those people.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the struggle that we're sort of working out at the moment.
And you still work with a printer that's like local and...
No, we don't now, just because, like say, with the costs. And the way we were having to run it, we use a bigger printer now, which just means that we can
ship more.
So we've got they've got places in the US, Europe, Australia, and so that.
Oh, just, you don't have to go through like customs and stuff.
No, so they just print closest to the customer.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah,
yeah. So that works really well, and just means that customers get stuff quicker, and
And they pay less probably too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And what have you learned from doing all this to from like founding the company and also just running it for a while? And I mean, you're still running it. I'm just, what have you learned?
Just that it is, I don't know, it kind of made me appreciate like illustration even more.
Yeah.
And how lucky I am to just sit there and draw, because there's so much involved in setting up a business. We did it ridiculously quickly as well. We did it in like 6 weeks from having the idea to launching it. And we were all completely wrecked. It was sort of like 6 weeks of 18 hour days. I had my RSI in both arms and ulcers on my throat. Yeah. So I was nearly dying.
Did your wife believe in it? Because you said she supported you before.
Yeah, she did. I mean,
yeah.
Like, there were times when she was like, this is insane.
Yeah.
But yeah, she does believe in it. She thinks it's good. And also, she's seen the hard work that's gone into it and the reaction. And
yeah.
But
how do you usually pick the artists that you're going to work with at Room 50? Is I imagine all three of you kind of come up with your picks, but
Well, I was kind of doing it to start with, and then so like I said, it's really important for us that we have a lot of women on there, so we would often contact the women first.
Yeah.
And make sure there were a lot of women involved. And then men, but really it's just who you can get as well, who's able to do it. Mm-hmm. When we started, we asked each illustrator to do three prints. And we kind of found we didn't want there to be an overwhelming amount of work on the site. And so obviously after a few seasons, if they're all doing three illustrations, it will just start to be overwhelming. So we've reduced that to one, and I think that's more manageable for the artists as well.
Yeah.
So
asked them to create an illustration that's original for this particular.
They don't have to create it. Okay. It might be a piece of work that they've done that would never see the light of day again, but that would work really well as a print. But we just asked that it hasn't been a print before and it won't be again, so it's exclusive as a print to Room 50.
Yeah. How do you find people? Like, do you find people mostly on Instagram or
mostly Instagram, but we also get submissions from people that we might not have heard of, and that's really great. So we'll go through that. I was doing it at the start, but then I've asked, I kind of feel uncomfortable as an illustrator having that role.
Uh-huh.
And when they're asking me, do you think this is okay and stuff, you know, I'll give my opinion, but that's all I feel it can be. I don't feel comfortable as an illustrator critiquing
work. I guess you could transition to thinking of yourself more as an art director as you go, but
I could do, but I don't. So
yeah, why not?
It's easier to give Chris and Ben that role, really.
But you have no aspiration to be that kind of person, really, I guess.
No. Not to be critical of. I don't feel it's my place to do it. But and also, as much as you can try and find a range of styles, you do have your own taste.
Yeah.
But
art directors have their own taste as well, I mean.
Yeah, but I think it's important. I asked, last season, I asked Ben and Hannah to choose all the artists.
Mm.
But we don't ever ask anyone to leave. It doesn't change every season.
Yeah.
So it's just if people aren't able to do a season and they've got to drop out or something like that.
Yeah.
We'll fill up the space.
Yeah.
But we're lucky that so many people do want to do it. You know, I think they.
How many submissions do you get usually per, like, I don't know. Do you get lots of people?
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot.
It's a lot, it's, yeah.
Yeah. It's probably maybe like, I don't know. It kind of varies, but it's, yeah, every week we have quite a few.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And I imagine you have a waiting list of some kind also.
Yeah, we just, you know, I guess it's partly having Room 50 that's made me understand better when I didn't used to hear back from art directors.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
You're just trying to keep so many plates spinning.
And you guys will only keep 50. I mean, that's part of your name. So I imagine you're not going to go over 50 or...
No. Yeah. No, we never do more than 50.
Well, that's already a lot to manage and coordinate, I feel. 50.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, yeah, it's like herding cats if you've got 50 artists.
Yeah.
Some of them are... Yeah, a bit tricky.
Yeah. So I know we're running out of time, but I wanted to see if you wanted to do some quick fire questions. I really like doing those because find out things about people that you don't really know. But I guess I added one after we started talking because you mentioned gambling on greyhounds and snooker, and I wanted to know what's your usual hobby or thing that you do besides illustration that brings you joy? Or...
Well, I don't go to the greyhounds anymore. It's actually, I found it's cruel to the dogs.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
I haven't been there for a long time.
Yeah, they're quite badly treated. It's physically, it's so demanding. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's not nice.
No.
And
you have a dog, I saw.
I have it, yeah, Mabel. She comes to work with me every day.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
So we drop off the girls and then we walk to the studio together.
Yeah.
So that's really nice. Other than that, nothing very interesting, unfortunately.
Yeah, but I mean...
Cycling.
Yeah, cycling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I recently had my birthday and I drank too much. So I've had like a week of introspection and shame. And so I've just been eating, like self-loathingly eating. And I went cycling this morning, actually. And it's amazing what a week of living like that can do to you. I look like a burst sausage.
You usually cycle like long distances. When people say they cycle, I never know if they mean they actually do it for long distances or.
Yeah. So I'll go out for a couple of hours.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Or so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I can't say I cycle if I just take a bike ride once in a while. Like
you can do. I'm not imposing any rules.
Yeah. But I feel like cycling implies wearing those spandex things and
yeah, that's essential.
And having that the speeds on your bike and yeah.
Yeah.
I just don't have that. My bike has one speed.
Oh really? You've got a single speed hipster bike?
I guess. I mean I don't use it the way that you know, the way where you can't brake. I find that quite scary, but yeah.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah.
I used to have one of those in London. You can't have those in Brighton. It's too hilly.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be pedaling the whole time. So
it doesn't even have a freewheel.
No, usually they don't because they break when you stop pedaling.
That's right, yeah.
Like yeah.
A proper track bike.
Yeah, they're insane. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't do that.
No, but I used to be obsessed with like training for triathlons.
Mm.
I'm very obsessive about things, so I'll become obsessed with something and then completely lose interest in it.
Yeah, yeah. So do you use an iPad Pro or a Cintiq? Because I've been talking to a lot of people and everybody seems to be on the iPad Pro band.
I still use a Cintiq, but I've been looking at iPad Pros.
Okay.
But they're just so expensive.
They are, but a Cintiq is quite expensive if you...
I know, but I've already got one. So
right, yeah. So, you have one of those really huge ones that are like...
I've got a big one.
Yeah.
I started with a small one.
Yeah.
And then I got a big one, but I only got one when I was getting enough work that I thought I could justify it. Before that, I did everything on paper. Just pen and paper.
What software do you usually use when you were working?
I use Clip Studio, which which is what used to be called...
That's original, yeah.
Manga,
something. Okay.
But I used to use Photoshop.
And you don't anymore?
No, and then Janne Ivanen, who's a Finnish illustrator, he came to work in my studio and he put me onto Clip Studio, which basically works functionally exactly like Photoshop. But it just, it's more geared towards drawing.
And also maybe without the subscription fee?
Without subscription fee, exactly, yeah.
It's become very expensive to own Adobe products.
Yeah, unless you know someone who can get you a free version.
Yeah, but they're cracking down on that, I've heard.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're really trying to lock everyone into the subscription, so...
Yeah. So yeah, I use that, but I still can't sketch on it at all.
Yeah. So what tools do you use to do most of your work, like analog tools?
I'll generally just use pen and paper to sketch all my ideas. And then when I'm going to do a final, I'll generally do a pretty final pencil sketch.
Mm. Are there particular like pens or pencils that you like using?
Yeah. What pen do I like using? I can't remember what it's called. It's a Rotring.
Mm. Okay.
It's not like the Isocrafts or anything.
There's the Isograph and there's the Rapidograph.
It might be the Rapidograph. It's disposable though. You just have to throw them away.
I don't think it's that then.
Is it a Tiki something?
Ah, it could be. Well, you can email me that later.
I'll email you that.
Yeah. Why do you use Rotring? Because I know they're quite expensive and they're pens that make very dependable kind of consistent lines. Is that why you start using it?
Yeah, I just like the feel of it.
Yeah.
It just really suits my style. Yeah, because it's such a consistent line.
Yeah. Well, your lines are quite thick, though.
Yeah. I use like a 0.5 or 0.7 or
something like that. Yeah. Because they're specialized in making very like thin... Very fine.
Oh yeah, I hate that.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't draw like that. It looks terrible when I draw like that.
And do you have a pencil you use that you usually use, or do you just use?
Yeah, I always just use a mechanical 0.7 pencil.
Oh, I see. Okay.
For the same reason, because it's quite thick and.
Yeah.
Yeah, I find if I draw too big, it leaves there's just more like room for error.
Ah, yeah.
And you can put in too much detail, and it all just gets too complicated. And I find that over time, I'll sketch bigger and bigger until it gets ridiculous, and then I'll go back to drawing tiny again.
It's hard to draw really big, I think.
Yeah, it is.
Do you usually, so you color all of your work digitally?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I don't feel confident about color, really.
Yeah.
So I couldn't imagine having to commit from the start to...
Yeah. I mean, very little. Actually, I don't think I've talked to one illustrator who really inks their work by hand anymore.
No, but why would you?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. What's a recent book that you read that you would recommend to others?
I've read so little since the girls were born. It's shameful. Did recently read Nomad, the Alan Partridge book. You probably don't know Alan Partridge, right?
I do, yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
I read that. It's really stupid, but it's like a perfect it's perfect January, February book.
Okay. How so?
Well, because there's just nothing to be gained from January. Like, you're not aiming for anything. It's just gloomy and depressing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was reading that one night in bed and I just read a line that, you know, when something tickles you and you can't stop laughing.
Yeah.
And I was laughing so much that my wife eventually said, what? And it took me about 5 minutes to even get the line out. And then she just said,
"Do you remember what it was?"
No. And she said, "It's not even that funny." And I said, and I was crying saying, "I know, I know." But that's really good.
Okay. I quite like him. Yeah. I find him pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, as a comedy nerd, I was like, when I first heard him on the radio, I was probably 13. Just like perfect age to get into him.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit in love with him.
What are some, do you watch series or comedy that?
Yeah, a lot. Like,
what's one of your favorites, I guess?
Larry Sanders Show.
Okay.
Absolutely love. Seinfeld is like my warm blanket.
Yeah, I love Seinfeld.
Like if I'm, yeah, I just know exactly
what you're going to get.
Yeah. Just rewatched all of The Sopranos again.
Yeah. It's not really comedy, but there's some comedic.
There's some elements. Really funny bits in it. Like I was actually just talking to a friend earlier today about Christopher's intervention. If you go onto YouTube and look at Christopher's intervention.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's got some really funny bits in it.
Yeah.
Like the first 10 seasons of The Simpsons, I think, are perfect.
Yeah.
And it was really good.
What's your favorite Seinfeld episode? Do you have one?
Oh, that's a really good question. I know as soon as I finish this, I'm just going to think of
another one.
So many.
Yeah.
I don't know why. All that's coming to mind is like the frozen yogurt one.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Where they find out that there are calories, that there are way more calories in the yogurt. Yeah. Yeah.
I love it when George gets the sable hat.
Yeah. Yeah.
He says, "Why didn't you get the big one?"
Yeah. I see.
Yeah.
That's cool. Do you listen to podcasts or music when you work?
Both actually. Both.
Okay.
Yeah.
What sort of podcasts do you listen to?
It's mostly like comedy stuff. So
okay.
I like Adam Buxton's podcast.
Uh-huh.
Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast.
Are these all British comedians?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Been recently listening to John Robbins and Ellis James. That's a British one.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to a really British nerdy comedy one, which is called Rule of Three, Comedians Comedian Podcast. It's all real, like, comedy stuff.
So you still listen to a lot of comedy?
Yeah, I would say, like, always my biggest love will be comedy.
Yeah. So if you had to recommend one for me that, because I've never heard of any of these comedians, which one would you recommend?
Probably Richard Herring.
Okay.
There's loads of them and it's really entertaining.
Okay, great. I'll check it out. I don't know that many British comedians, I guess.
Well, that would be a perfect like introduction to it.
Yeah. I mean, I watched some British like comedies that I liked, but comedians, I guess, is different. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's mostly stand-ups.
Yeah.
But he interviews some American ones like David Cross and he's had a few.
Hmm. That's great. And the final question I want to ask you is if you could give one piece of advice to people who are starting out, young creatives who are trying to become illustrators, what would it be?
I think probably just like we were talking about, it's just the perseverance and just to see it as a process rather than as to just see the silence as part of the process rather than negative feedback.
Yeah.
It's not negative feedback. It's just literally no feedback.
It's just silence. Yeah.
It's just silence. And it's just part of, that's just part, you just have to go through that part. And just keep producing your work. Don't feel bad. And don't feel bad about feeling bad, because people just feel bad sometimes. Like, the feeling bad is bad enough.
Yeah.
Just, like, go through it. Yeah, and good luck.
Yeah. All right. Well, Leon, thank you so much for being here and taking my questions.
You're welcome.
You've been a really good guest. Is that your kid in the back?
My daughter just ran in from school.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I'll probably keep that in. Yeah. So people know you really have kids.
So I actually have kids.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, I mean, you're obviously really busy, but yeah. So thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah. No, thank you. I hope it wasn't too boring.
No, not at all. And here was my conversation with Leon Edler. Remember to go check out Leon's Instagram at it's Lelo, and also to go check out his website, www.lelo.com. And I will list all of that as well as the address for the Room 50 website on the show notes for today's episode, which you can find at illustrationhour.com/Edler. So thank you so much for tuning in again, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Illustration Hour.